Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Why it's bad luck to say good luck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, we dive into the world of superstition in music, theater, and more. And Bree Benton, a.k.a. Poor Baby Bree, gives us a performance from her one-woman vaudeville show, I Am Going to Run Away. But we begin with one alarmingly paranoid crowd. And given the number of things that can go wrong with a performance, no wonder that musicians and actors are such a superstitious bunch. There are some things you just don't do. Whistle backstage? Never. Wish a co-star good luck? How dare you? And definitely don't say the name of Shakespeare's play Macbeth aloud. Which could be a problem because the city right now, full of Macbeth productions. Joining us to talk about some of these strange behaviors is David Cody, theater editor from Time Out New York. Good to see you, David.
Thanks, John. I'm looking over my shoulder here. I'm worried.
I have to say, I wished David good luck just before the mics opened.
Oh, man.
Knowing exactly what I was doing. What was I doing?
When I leave here, I got to double check the elevator, make sure it's actually there, an empty shaft.
Let me start with, there's so many of these superstitions that go with the performing arts, but Verdi's opera Macbeth is at the Met, and there are several other productions of Macbeth and Macbeth-based things, either currently running or imminent here in New York. That's a lot of places where you can't say the name Macbeth.
I can't even say it at home. My wife, who trained in London to be an actress, she's an audiobook narrator. She won't even let me. I love to quote Macbeth all the time. Now, occasionally you'll want to say, is this a dagger I see before me? Or tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day. But she freaks out. So I can't even say it. But yeah, instead of saying.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, the play has witches in it. And there's all this crazy sort of lore that Shakespeare actually incorporated real spells into the text of the play, and this notion that maybe the very first production of it in Elizabethan London, somebody died from a real dagger being used. I mean, there's all this crazy stuff that floats around that productions of Macbeth are inherently cursed or prone to terrible calamities.
Hmm. And has this been borne out? I mean, have we seen terrible calamities?
I've seen terrible Macbeths. Kelsey Grammer in 2000, that cursed me for a few weeks.
If somebody, just loses their mind and actually backstage at the Met tonight utters the word Macbeth, is there an antidote?
There is the cleansing process.
Really?
Yes. And there's no, like many of these superstitions, there's no, agreement over what exactly it is. But it involves some combination of leaving the theater, maybe turning around three times, spitting over your left shoulder, quoting.
Oh, this is the Widdershins thing. You have to spin around Widdershins counterclockwise.
Yeah. I'm learning things all day about this. But and then you're supposed to quote from another Shakespeare play. I always heard it was you have to quote from a comedy. But it can be anything, really, I suppose.
Anything but Macbeth.
And you have to be invited back into the theater.
So the Metropolitan Opera, one of a number of places here in New York with a Macbeth theme, there's that production Sleep No More, which actually has some fun with this whole superstition, right? They incorporate all of this.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating production, especially if looked at as an adaptation of Macbeth. I mean, because I don't think there's a lot of the text of the play in it at all. In fact, there's very little. It's performed by dancers mostly who aren't speaking lines. So, but the sort of the aura of Macbeth permeates every moment of that show.
And this is the thing where the audience is in motion, moving from one tableau or scenario to another.
It's like a huge performance art installation taking up about two warehouses. And it doesn't look like a traditional production of Macbeth, but it's sort of like the essence of Macbeth.
But they'll say Macbeth.
I'm sure they must.
As opposed to the Scottish play, which is what you're supposed to say.
Or Macker's.
Really?
Yes.
Macker's?
He's playing Macker's over at, Lincoln Center.
Well, in fact, at Lincoln Center, Thomas Hampson is singing the role of Macker's in Verdi's Macbeth.
A contenta per la scoccia si diffonda l'ira mio la mia vendetta per la scoccia si diffonda come fiera in corna bonda come fiera in corna bonda come l'arima massa.
Thomas Hampson in the role of Mackers from the Giuseppe Verdi opera Macbeth, based on the Shakespearean play that you cannot say in the theater. That is one of the many superstitions that have grown up around the performing arts, whether it's theater or music or dance. And we're speaking with David Cody, theater editor for Time Out New York, about just some of them. And Soundcheck listeners, what about you? Are you a performer of some sort? Do you have a pre-show routine or ritual or superstition? Have you ever seen a fellow artist do something very superstitious? You can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. And again, the webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And actually joining us on the line now is Billy Mitchell, the historian for the famed Apollo Theater in Harlem. Billy, welcome back to Soundcheck.
It's my pleasure, John. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Now, I understand there is a kind of superstitious tradition that's developed there at the Apollo.
That's exactly right. The Tree of Hope, which is a tree stump that every amateur contestant rubs before they perform, that came from that superstitious element. People used to rub it for good luck, hoping that they would get jobs, but that became a superstition because a lot of people rubbed the tree back in the old days who stood around that tree, which incidentally was located outside the old Lafayette Theater. It was located on 131st Street and Adam Clayton Powell. Now, back in the old days, unemployed entertainers would gather around the tree and sing, dance, play their instruments, recite poetry. They did that hoping that someone would see them, like what they did, and hire them. Well, before you could snap your finger, booking agents heard about these people performing around the tree, and they came up to Harlem and they started hiring every performer who performed around it. So being hired and superstitious, the performers thought the reason they were hired is because the tree was giving off good luck.
So now, is this just, I mean, you know, we hear the Apollo has had like all the greats performing there over the years. Is it only the amateurs who rub the tree?
Well, it started with amateur night, but when we have shows, you know, people request to be able to rub the tree because they know the tradition. So it's just not that we put it out for amateur night. That's where it started. But when we have concerts sometimes, when we have special events, people ask to rub the Tree of Hope.
And how long has it been there?
Since the 1930s.
Wow.
Since the late night. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, man. Billy, I love the idea of the great James Brown going backstage there at the Apollo in 1962 and rubbing the Tree of Hope. Billy Mitchell is the historian for the Apollo. Let's hear James Brown recorded there in 1962. Billy, thank you for calling in today.
It's my absolute pleasure, John. I look forward to speaking to you again.
You know I feel all right. Yeah. You know I feel all right, children. I feel all right. Yeah. If you leave me, I'm gonna play dead. If you leave me, I'm gonna play dead.
James Brown, live at the Apollo, 1962, I'll Go Crazy. He sounds like he rubbed that Tree of Hope and rubbed it real good. You'd heard of this one, David?
No, I didn't. I've been up to the Apollo a few times to review, but I haven't heard of that tradition.
We are learning about lots of superstitions in the performing arts today on Soundcheck. And joining us on the line from Connecticut College is the psychologist Stuart Vise. He's author of the book Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. Stuart, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Glad to be here.
So you heard Billy Mitchell talking about how the superstition grew up around this tree of hope at the Apollo. It seems like it was, in fact, well, you'll pardon the pun, rooted in some kind of actual truth. You know, people hung around this tree, they got work. Is that how these superstitions happen?
Sometimes they do, definitely. And, you know, while we're on the topic of the theater, for example, the superstition about not whistling on stage or mm-hmm. backstage, do you know about that one?
Right.
And my understanding is that it has it's rooted in the days when there were these big tapestry sceneries going up and down that had to be lifted by pulleys, and the way the crew actually communicated with each other was by whistling. And so if you whistled by, you know, just randomly backstage, you might end up with a fairly large piece of scenery on your head.
I would add that
has lasted beyond the time when this was the mode of communication.
Uh-huh.
Sorry to interrupt there, but I think the reason for the whistling thing system being put in place also is that in the 18th and 19th century, as stage technology got more and more advanced, they actually were employing sailors backstage as stagehands.
Because they knew the ropes.
They knew ropes.
Literally.
And
they
yeah.
knew the ropes.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So that does happen. Yeah. And then, you know, after that is no longer the case, the superstition has a life of its own often.
Right. So break a leg, for example. No one seems to know where this one comes from, but it has, Stuart, as you say, kind of taken on a life of its own in the theater. Are theater people, or musicians, singers, actors, do they tend to be more superstitious than the rest of us?
Well, yes. I mean, it is the case that there are these different professions where superstition seems to be part of the culture. It's a bonding thing. It's a language that you learn when you enter into that society. And so you have sailors, you have actors. Certainly, sports, baseball is rife with superstitions that are unique to the game and are part of the culture of the sport. So, once you enter into those groups, it is very common. And of course, they have in common, high stakes in many cases, great uncertainty about what's going to happen. If you make a mistake on stage, it's really hard to hide that. You know, mm-hmm. it's going to be seen by many, many people. And so, these are professions that have those sort of features to them.
So, a high-stakes profession. You mentioned athletes, and especially baseball, and I'm thinking of, you know, many managers, when they go out to remove a pitcher, you'll actually see them kind of step over the first base or third base line and not step on it.
Right.
Which is, kind of like, I guess, a grown-up version of step on a crack, break your mother's back, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
What about, there's something similar, the Russian classical pianist Shura Tchaikovsky had a kind of similar thing.
Right. Evidently, he used to always step on the stage with his right foot first, and so this was just a little ritual that he had. And apparently, he was a pretty superstitious guy in general. He had a number of superstitions. I don't know them all, but I know that one was that he was sort of compulsive or superstitious about practicing. That he, you know, to not practice was something that he was very frightened to do.
Mm.
I mean, that's actually, again, there's a superstition that might have a rational piece to it.
Absolutely. But using the right foot to step out on stage all the time, that's just plain old superstition from this guy, Shura Tchaikovsky. That is Shora Tchaikovsky playing Chopin, Impromptu number 2 in E-flat, presumably having used his right foot first to step into the recording studio. We're talking about superstition in the performing arts. David Cody's here with me in the studio, theater editor for Time Out New York. And Stuart Vise is with us on the line, author of the book Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. And Krista is on the line with us from Trumbull, Connecticut. Hi, Krista.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, so you're a singer?
Yes, I'm an opera singer. And there are some unique superstitions in Italy that I've come across. I don't know if they're unique to the opera or if it's all stage in Italy, but I was singing in South Korea with an Italian tenor, and I had a purple scarf that I was wearing, and he told me that it was terrible luck to go on the stage wearing purple.
Wow.
I don't know where that comes from or why. One other is from a musical in Italy. A costume had peacock feathers in it, and the other actors were making the sign of the horn, which is kind of like the evil eye, you know.
To ward off the evil eye, yeah.
Right.
Wow. David, have you heard the peacock feather thing before?
You know, that was new to me, and it's very interesting because, I mean, I don't know where that comes from. Is proud as a peacock, pride goeth before the fall? Is it something? I will say, though, that back in the 90s, I did a very strange deconstructed version of Othello, and I played a very strange character in it, and my costume incorporated peacock feathers. I won't say how, because if I did, I wouldn't be able to look you in the eye. But it's true. And if I had known...
Family show.
No, not quite.
I mean, I have heard this before, that no peacock feathers should be allowed inside a theater. I've never actually seen anybody do that or freak out because someone else did. But, I've heard of that as a thing, as a superstition.
And also wearing green in rehearsal apparently is bad luck.
Now, Krista told us she was an opera singer. There is this this toy thing. Stuart, have you come across this?
No.
David, you've heard of toy.
Yeah, it's the alternative to saying good luck, you know, before a performance.
And the thing is, Stuart, that strikes me about this is you can't just say toy or toy. You have to say it 3 times. And numbers... A lot of these superstitions sort of devolve into numbers games, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. The ritual bouncing of the basketball X number of times before you take your free throw or whatever. There is a romance in the repeated act, I think, making it sort of an incantation. The other thing too is that sometimes there's a sense of mantra-like soothing that can come from the exercise of a quote ritual or a superstition, depending upon what you call it, and I think there may be some real benefit to that.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that ritual actions or breathing can relieve stress. So
absolutely, and coaches often will recommend if a player does not have one to sort of that the player establish a pregame ritual, sort of doing everything the same way, and I think that's exactly what it is to sort of calm you, give you something to focus on that will keep you from building up anxiety before the performance.
Well, there's a photo on our website of a guitarist at the Apollo Theater rubbing that tree of hope that we were talking about before, and you know, you could see where that would be kind of this thing has been worn smooth over the decades. You could see how that might be a calming thing to, you know, a calming sensation on a sweaty palm before you head out on that famous stage. Let's go back to the phones, because we've got a couple of people who claim to know the derivation of the term break a leg. And they're different derivations, both of them. Jonathan First in Brooklyn, and we'll also be speaking with Ken in Glen Cove. Jonathan First, how are you, Jonathan?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
So you know the history of break a leg.
Well, I was told it back in college during my study of restoration comedies and performance of restoration comedy, an infamously foppish form of theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the break a leg, I was told, is to turn the right leg out so that the calf could be seen, to break a leg forward so that you could see the calf. And it was a way of standing on stage when delivering lines. So these were stockinged, and men's in stockings, you would turn your leg outward, and that was to break a leg.
And so the idea is that in those, and we've talked a little bit about this in the world of ballet, too, in restoration times a couple of centuries ago, it was the men's legs that everyone was looking at. And so, yeah, to kind of show off a well-shaped calf would have been something important. But Ken in Glen Cove, not the story you've heard, huh?
The story I've read is somewhat different from the one that you just heard. I heard that break a leg referred to the bow that an actor would take after a performance and after he'd had encores. That is, he bent a leg, not broke a leg. And this was to express his pleasure at being applauded. The other part of this same Elizabethan theater ritual was that the groundlings, I guess, but the other people in the theater would frequently throw coins on the stage to express their admiration, and the actor would have to bend his leg. He would have to kneel down in order to pick up the coins. So the breaking the leg was appreciation first, that they liked it.
So it was two things. So it's, yeah, so breaking a leg meant you were getting applause, so you were taking bows, and perhaps picking some change up off the foot of the stage.
You know, the more specific the explanation, the more I believe it.
Well, now, we're not done yet. We're not done, because Corinne has yet another explanation for where the term break a leg comes from, and Corinne is a professional dancer, so I'm going to give her story no more credibility than anybody else's. Go ahead, Corinne. What you got for us?
I was told that the side wing curtains that separate the wing on stage right and stage left, those are actually called the legs. And to break a leg literally meant to be on and off stage so many times for your curtain call to actually break the leg of the curtain, because I was told that in the 1800s, a professional ballerina had so many curtain calls that she got tangled in the leg of the curtain.
Well, that's pretty specific. Good enough for you, David?
Well, that obviously would date the origin of the phrase when we started having curtains in theaters. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, today, break a leg might be, you know, get into a show like Spider-Man that is, people get injured, but it runs forever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as Stuart said, you know, very often, wherever these things come from, they end up taking on a life of their own. What about, Stuart, you know, things that are specific to one kind of job or another? I mean, you talked about athletes, we've talked about actors and singers. Do these things ever kind of spread into the wider society? Have we picked up superstitions from music or acting or baseball or what have you?
I'm not sure that. I think that they're actually more likely to be stuck within that group. As I say, more as almost a membership thing. I know, for example, that our basketball team, women's basketball team, used to believe that if they went to Dunkin' Donuts the night before a game, that after practice, that somehow made them win. And so they did this as a ritual, and it was something that only they would do, you know, themselves. So I don't think so. I mean, there may be the idea that, you know, if you've been a member of one of these groups and sort of practice this stuff, that you may then, as an individual, start doing things in the other parts of your life, but I don't. Other than that, I'm not convinced that that's the case.
All right. Oh, we're speaking with Stuart Vise. He's author of the book Believing in Magic: The Psychology of Superstition. David Cody, theater editor for Time Out New York. Calls on the line, comments on the website, and Joel Meyer in the control room with some of those comments.
John, you know, we've mentioned the Macbeth superstition and the current Broadway production of Spider-Man in the same segment, John, so I think this one kind of fits in that genre. Ra from Manhattan writes, I was in the audience of the off-Broadway preview of the play Scattergood, starring Brian Murray a couple of years ago. I had just had a new photo taken, and I told my partner that it made me look like Lady Macbeth. Realizing my error, fear overtook me. My partner laughed it off. Sure enough, three-quarters of the way through the performance, there was a crash. Everything stopped. Mr. Murray had fallen backstage. No serious injury, but still, I'll never utter that word again in a theater.
All right, so the Scottish play strikes again, and we end up where we began, knowing nothing more than we began with in terms of where these superstitions come from, only that they are out there, and they have, as Stuart has told us, lives of their own. To everyone who's called and commented, thanks. Glad to hear from you. David Cody, great to have you back with us
here
in
John.
The studio. Stuart Vise, thanks for joining us on the line.
A pleasure.
The song is called Knock on Wood. There are many versions of it. This one comes from Amy Stewart. Up next, a live performance from Bree Benton, a.k.a. Poor Baby Bree. She brings a taste of her one-woman vaudeville show live to our studio. And then later on the show, we remember the revolutionary banjo player, Earl Scruggs, who passed away yesterday. This is Soundcheck.